Today is Wednesday, October the 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. FBI agents raid the homes in Washington and New York City linked to a Russian billionaire. Authors of a new report on Africa's climates warn that the continent is heating up more and faster than other regions of the world.
Three African glaciers, Mount Kenya, Rwenzori, and Kilimanjaro, and you can see that there has been a major loss. If the current trends continue, we won't see any glaciers in Africa.
And Lebanon's defense minister says that no one should jump to conclusions about the deadly sectarian violence that erupted last Thursday in the capital, Beirut.
Hezbollah put themselves in a corner. It is in their own self-interest. If they back down, the best thing for them is to lay low.
And former President Donald Trump has filed a lawsuit against the January 6th House Select Committee and the National Archives. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, a report by the U.S. Navy finds major failures in a five-day arson fire that destroyed a ship in San Diego in 2020. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The report calls the fire preventable and unacceptable. An arson fire last year in San Diego burned for 5 days and destroyed the USS Bonhomme Richard.
And have sustained damage. The forward mast has collapsed and the ship is listing.
The report, obtained by the AP, lists 36 officers and sailors whose failings either directly led to the ship's loss or contributed to it. The report says an act of arson started the fire, but the ship was lost because of an inability to extinguish the fire. The report describes a ship in disarray. It spreads blame across a wide range of ranks and responsibilities, including the now-retired 3-star admiral who headed Naval Surface Force Pacific Fleet, Vice Admiral Richard Brown. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Former President Donald Trump has filed a suit against the House Select Committee and the National Archives as the standoff intensifies over a former advisor's refusal to testify before the committee investigating the deadly Capitol attack in January. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
Former President Trump is trying to block the release of documents related to the January 6th insurrection, heading to court to challenge President Biden's decision to waive executive privilege on those items. Trump called it a vexatious, illegal fishing expedition. But last week, Biden's press secretary said,
"There's nothing political about working to ensure that the events of January 6th never happen again."
The January 6th committee is scheduled to vote today to hold former Trump advisors Steve Bannon in criminal contempt of Congress. He defied a subpoena relating to his role in the attempt to violently block Joe Biden's presidential certification from taking place. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Colin Powell, the first black U.S. Secretary of State and top military officer, died on Monday at the age of 84 from complications due to COVID-19. His family wrote in a statement on Facebook that he was fully vaccinated and that they had lost a remarkable and loving husband, father, grandfather, and a great American. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb shares more on Powell's legacy.
Colin Powell was a respected military general, statesman, and one of America's foremost black figures. He served as National Security Advisor under President Ronald Reagan, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President George H.W. Bush, and finally Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, the first African-American to ever serve in the latter two leadership posts.
I was sitting in my office and one of the senior members of the staff came in and closed the door and said, "Sir, I have to ask you something." And a lot of confusion in the building. "So what's wrong?" He said, "Well, what do we call you? Do we call you General or Mr. Secretary?" And I said, "By all means, it's Mr. Secretary. Now drop and give me 10.
Michael O'Hanlon is a defense expert with the Brookings Institution.
The passing of Colin Powell is the end of an era. He personified the great excellence and achievement of African Americans in our nation's armed forces, in some ways perhaps even paving the way for the Obama presidency.
In 1996, Powell considered a bid to become the first black president, but his wife discouraged him out of fear of potential assassination attempts from extremists. When Democrat Barack Obama made the bid years later, The moderate Republican broke with his party to endorse Obama. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, the first black U.S. defense secretary, called Powell a tremendous mentor and friend.
He always made time for me, and I could always go to him with tough issues. He always had great counsel. We will certainly miss him. I feel as if I have a hole in my heart.
Wounded twice as a young soldier in Vietnam, the war shaped his views of when and how presidents should and should not use armed forces.
He knew that war and military action should always be a last resort.
Powell received high praise for his overwhelming use of force in the Gulf War, which quickly pushed Iraqi forces out of Kuwait in 1991. But critics have denounced his controversial presentation to the U.N. Security Council in February 2003. Powell made the case for the invasion of Iraq during the George W. Bush administration, citing Iraqi weapons of mass destruction that were never found.
The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community.
John Isaacs is with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation.
That's probably the major blemish on his record, but it really wasn't only his blemish. It was the whole intelligence community. I think there are 13 different intelligence agencies, and 12 out of 13 said Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, and he studied and then he came to agree. They were all wrong. They're all wrong.
Even Powell later called the presentation a, quote, blot in his career. Today, Republicans and Democrats alike uphold him as a man of honor and a patriot to the end. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
North Korea test-fired a submarine-launched ballistic missile, or SLBM, Tuesday. The test comes a month after South Korea conducted its own SLBM launch, as VOA's Bill Gower reports from Seoul.
Concerns of an arms race on the Korean Peninsula intensified Tuesday. North Korea conducted its eighth major weapons test this year, this time of a submarine-launched ballistic missile, or SLBM. SLBMs would add an unpredictable component to North Korea's arsenal. They're mobile and easier to hide. It's not the first time North Korea has tested an SLBM, but it is the first such test in 2 years. The timing is important. It comes just a month after South Korea launched its own SLBM. In 2 days, South Korea will try to launch its first homegrown space rocket. South Korea, which hosts about 28,000 U.S. troops, is building up its military so it can take on more of its own defense. North Korea, though, views the moves as provocative. Seoul-based analyst Park Won-gon says North Korea is using the South Korean launches as justification for its own nuclear development. North Korea is banned from any ballistic missile activity by a series of United Nations Security Council resolutions. Those resolutions were put in place to punish North Korea for its illicit nuclear program. In North Korea's view, those resolutions are an example of the United States and its allies employing double standards. On Monday in Washington, Sung Kim, the U.S. envoy for North Korea, reiterated the U.S. offer to resume talks aimed at making progress on denuclearization.
The U.S. continues to reach out to Pyongyang to restart dialogue. Our intent remains the same. We harbor no hostile intent towards the DPRK, and we are open to meeting with them without preconditions.
In a speech last week, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un rejected the U.S. offer, saying there's no evidence the United States has dropped what he called a hostile policy. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that the Biden administration intends to move ahead with its plan to reopen the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem. The consulate had traditionally served as a base for the U.S. government to engage with Palestinians until it was closed in 2019. However, Israel is opposed to the plan, saying that the move would undermine Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's new government. Orly Halpern is a reporter based in Jerusalem. She tells me that the former consulate was closed by former President Donald Trump's administration in favor of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem to support Israel's claim on the city as its capital.
basically, Trump administration downgraded the Palestinian connection, diplomatic relations with the Palestinians, when it closed the U.S. consulate that was specifically for Palestinians and moved all kinds of diplomatic relations with the Palestinians to a special unit inside the U.S. embassy in Israel. And this basically meant that the relations between the U.S. and the Palestinians was less important than the relations with Israel. And now the Biden administration, following the promise of U.S. President Joe Biden, is planning on opening it back up.
It has been said that Prime Minister Bennett's opposition to the opening of the Palestinian consulate was in ways a matter of principle. It's not related to any political timing. How does he, for one, diverge from his predecessor on this particular issue?
Both the former Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the present Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, are on the same page regarding reopening or the existence of a consulate for the U.S. To have relations with the Palestinians. They're both right-wing. They don't want the city of Jerusalem to be divided and that the Palestinians have East Jerusalem as their capital. So they certainly are not interested, neither of them, in this consulate being reopened.
Okay, so they're on the same page in that regard. Let's talk about the composition of the current coalition. How would you characterize the current Israeli government? For someone who has not been keeping up with Israeli politics, who are the members of the coalition and on which side of this debate do they fall?
Well, at present, Israel has a very fragile coalition. It's made up of right-wingers and left-wingers and an Islamist party, and basically what they do have in common was that they wanted to get rid of Netanyahu. And that's why they agreed, despite their very deep ideological differences, to come together, put those differences aside just to run the country. So they're not, they've agreed that they're not going to deal with any of the contentious issues, which is like negotiating with the Palestinians, for example, because that could break up this coalition. So in terms of support or opposition to this move by the Biden administration, you have both in this government. You have, the Meretz left-wing party, and I'm sure the Islamist party and the Labor party, who are all in favor of opening a consulate where Washington has a direct line of communication with the Palestinians, whereas the right-wingers, which the Prime Minister Bennett is a part of, totally oppose it. They want Jerusalem to be the capital only of Israel.
And how would opening the consulate affect this coalition?
I don't think it will, because it's not their decision. They're not deciding to do it. It's the U.S. decision.
So what is the conversation like in among Palestinians and regular Israeli on this topic of reopening the consulate?
Well, for the Palestinians, it's very positive. I mean, they are interested in having relations, diplomatic relations, again with the U.S. Those ties were cut during the Trump administration, and this is a signal that the Americans are interested in renewing cooperation with the Palestinians. So that's very positive. But right-wing Israelis, which are pretty much the majority of Israelis, are less enthusiastic. There were 130 family members of Israelis who were killed by Palestinians who protested, sent a letter of protest demanding that the U.S. does not reopen this consulate. And it's interesting because during the Trump administration, the person who Trump designated as the ambassador was a very right-wing Jewish-American pro-settler movement. He was made the ambassador of the U.S. embassy in Israel, and Trump moved that embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. By making someone who is in favor of settlements in the West Bank, in the Palestinian territories, the ambassador and overseeing relations also between Palestinians and America, it showed how what a conflict of interest there was, and how the Palestinian side was really downgraded. So this is now going to change. And the Palestinians see it as very positive, and the Americans see it as very important.
Reporter Early Halpin, she joined us from Jerusalem. Lebanon's defense minister says that no one should jump to conclusions about the deadly sectarian violence that erupted last Thursday in the capital, Beirut. However, the leader of the powerful Shia faction, Hezbollah, lashed out on Monday, accusing the Christian Lebanese forces of stoking civil war. And for VOA, Del Gavlak reports from Amman.
Lebanese Defense Minister Maurice Sleem said the demonstration Thursday by followers of Hezbollah deviated from its course and clashes erupted. The protesters were demanding that Judge Tariq Bitar be removed from the investigation into the giant explosion at the Beirut port that rocked the entire city last year. Thursday's confrontation sparked fears of a possible sectarian conflict along the lines of the 1975 to 1990 civil war. The clashes killed 7 people and wounded 32. So far, 20 people from Hezbollah and the Lebanese forces have been arrested. Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah, in a speech on Monday, accused the Lebanese forces of killing its supporters and inciting civil war. He boasted that his group had 100,000 fighters, but said they were meant to defend Lebanon from external enemies, not to engage in an internal conflict. Political analyst Dania Khalia Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut told VOA both sides need to bring the tensions down and for the probe into the 2020 port explosion to continue.
Hezbollah put themselves in a corner. It is in their own self-interest. If they back down, the best thing for them is to lay low. If they are intelligent, they would accept the investigation. And even if it leads to them, what we see now from them is the arrogance of power. And it's not only Hezbollah.
Lebanese forces leader Samir Jaja, an adversary of Hezbollah, meanwhile, has denied organizing last week's violence. He said Nasrallah and other political leaders need to focus on getting the country and the citizens out of the tragic situation Lebanon faces, including economic collapse and an energy crisis. Many Lebanese also say they want to see justice achieved for those who lost their lives, were injured, or made homeless by the Beirut port blast, one of the biggest non-nuclear explosions in history. Observers say the lead investigator, Judge Tariq Bitar, must not be hampered by any party. Otherwise, they say the probe will go nowhere. Meanwhile, analysts say Lebanon's new government, formed last month, could be paralyzed by divisions, including objections by Hezbollah over Bitar. By trying to question 3 former ministers about the blast who have links to Hezbollah, the judge has found himself in a political battle that once again brings Lebanon to the brink. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Voice of America!
And still in Lebanon, thousands of students are dropping out of school as parents are unable to afford the tuition fees due to the dire economic situation. Reporters said that more than 15% of the teachers have left the country looking for jobs abroad. George Eid reports for VOA from Beirut.
More than 90,000 Lebanese students have already been moved from private schools to public schools since the economic crisis broke out in 2019, says the education ministry in Lebanon. This comes at a time when many Lebanese parents are struggling with the education cost of their children. Faris Jabra, who lives in Beirut with his family, says that his budget is now considerably tighter and he is barely able to cover the basic educational needs of his kids.
Again, it's very overwhelming. Everything expensive. Like even the books and even the copy books, the writing books, writing materials. It's insane. Like the thinnest copy book is for 40,000 and 50,000 Lebanese lira in a library. And all this we need to buy. So I don't know how it's going to work out.
Luna, on the other hand, a mother with an only child, is no longer able to pay for the education of her child.
I'm a mother of a child who's 8 years old, and my girl this year is going to be in grade 3. I cannot afford her tuition, since tuition fees are 40% more than they used to be in Lebanon. It breaks my heart that our kids have to go through this, and we have to go through this.
No fewer than 15% of Lebanon's 53,000 private school teachers have left the country, creating a large shortage, the teachers' union declared recently. The country's network of Catholic schools, which used to educate 185,000 pupils, last year lost 9,000 of them and was forced to close 14 of its 321 facilities. Najat Alusta, who lives in central Lebanon, is the director of Sanabel School, and she says that more and more parents are unable to pay for the tuition of their kids. She says parents are unable to pay the tuition fees and we are unable to pay our teachers. 40% of our students have left the school. They are no longer able to afford the fees. This is really sad for the future of our country. In a recent report, the UN says poverty now affects more than three-quarters of the population in Lebanon. On the other hand, education seems to have become a luxury not many are able to afford in Beirut these days. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
And in other news, FBI agents on Tuesday raided the homes in Washington and New York City linked to Oleg Deripaska, a Russian billionaire with ties to the Kremlin, and to Paul Manafort, the one-time chairman of Donald Trump's 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. A spokesperson for the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation confirmed that the agency was conducting a court-authorized law enforcement activity at the home. Deripaska is a billionaire oil tycoon with close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. He was among two dozen Russian oligarchs and officials who were sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department in April 2018. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Astronomers say that increasing light pollution, such as the brightening of the night skies from artificial light, is making exploration of the cosmos from ground-based telescopes more difficult. A new study provides evidence that more than 10% of the night sky brightness above natural light levels is due to satellites and other objects orbiting Earth. Rick Pantaleo tells us more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Because of a growing problem called light pollution, more of us are unable to witness the full, breathtaking beauty and majesty of the sparkling Milky Way. Light pollution is defined as the brightening of the night sky from artificial light sources such as streetlights. A new study from scientists in the U.S., Slovakia, and Spain provides evidence that satellites and other artificial objects that orbit Earth are also contributing more to light pollution than previously understood. The study, published in the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, Letters, suggests that these Earth-orbiting objects may be increasing light pollution across a large segment of our planet by more than 10% above natural light levels. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. Authors of a new report on Africa's climate warn that the continent is heating up more and faster than other regions in the world, and they say that Africa needs immediate financial and technological assistance to adapt to the warming environment. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The African continent constitutes 17% of the global population, but is responsible for less than 4% of greenhouse gas emissions, which are leading to climate change. The report finds changing precipitation patterns, rising temperatures, and extreme weather triggered by climate change are happening globally, but notes these events are occurring with greater frequency and intensity in Africa. Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Petteri Talas, says there were 700 major disasters on the continent last year. He says more than half have been flooding events and one-sixth have been storming and drought events, respectively.
We have seen almost 100 million people who have suffered of food insecurity, and they needed humanitarian assistance and the combined effects of conflicts, climate hazards, and especially this COVID-19, they have been contributing to the increase of 40% of food insecurity.
This multi-agency report entitled State of the Climate in Africa 2020 was coordinated by the World Meteorological Organization with the help of the African Union Commission and various UN agencies. The report finds the warming trend over the last three decades in all African subregions was stronger than in the previous 30 years. During this period, it says Africa has warmed faster than the global average temperature over land and ocean combined. It says higher than normal precipitation and flooding predominated in places such as the Sahel, the Rift Valley, and the Kalahari Basin. At the same time, dry conditions prevailed in the northern coast of the Gulf of Guinea and other locations, while drought in Madagascar triggered a humanitarian crisis. Tala says sea level rise is threatening many coastal cities in Africa like Lagos, Nigeria's economic hub and a major financial center in Africa. He says climate change also is having a devastating impact on the last remaining glaciers in East Africa.
Three African glaciers, Mount Kenya, Rwenzori and Kilimanjaro, and you can see that there has been major loss of the sea ice area and also sea ice mass. And if the current trends continue, we won't see any glaciers in Africa in 2040s.
The African Union Commission reports adaptation costs in sub-Saharan Africa are estimated at $30 billion to $50 billion, equivalent to 2 to 3% of regional gross domestic product each year over the next decade. However, it notes the cost of doing nothing will be much higher. By 2030, it says up to 118 million extremely poor people will be subject to devastating impacts of drought and intense heat. It adds subsequent displacement and migration consequently will lead to a further 3% decrease in GDP by 2050. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The East African community has suspended the recruitment of staff from member states, citing irregularities and the breaching of the community's treaty in the quota system. As Moses Havyarimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania's Council of Ministers is set to consider investigating or relaunching the process.
An almost one-week standoff in the East African Legislative Assembly came to an end as the staff recruitment process was suspended after member states of Burundi, South Sudan, and Uganda pulled out, citing irregularities. Ken Obura is a deputy minister for East African Community from Kenya.
I therefore ask for the indulgence of this House to allow the Council of Ministers to take up this matter, to address it, and I commit to this House, Honorable Speaker, that we will address this matter in the best interest of the community, acting for the greater good of the citizens of this community.
This comes after last week Uganda and South Sudan called for the suspension of the ongoing recruitment process of the East African community organs and institutions. Dennis Namara is a lawmaker from Uganda.
So the motion that has been on the floor has been to fight for the rights of the marginalized countries that joined the integration, and one of them is the Republic of South Sudan. This was a motion of principles that you are breaching the treaty, you are breaching the quota system. And then there's this lie of the thing of affirmative action.
The staff rules and regulations requires that the recruitment of staff will be done by quota system, which provides partner states equal representation. Paul Musamali is a lawmaker from Uganda.
I want to assure the people of East Africa, we are not going to relent. Council has agreed to take it up, to suspend the recruitment, look at it, and start afresh. If they do not put in action that pledge which they made here, which the chairperson of council made here on the floor, we shall still come back. We are going to make their lives difficult. And them not make this community to run as if they are running their private enterprises. This is a community of over 170 million people.
Kennedy Mukulia is a lawmaker from South Sudan.
We expect them as soon as possible. In fact, by tomorrow, they have to address our issues. If they don't address their issues, we bring back this motion. So they have to consider this matter urgently because it's a matter of regional importance. So we cannot proceed to hear for reports that does not matter the people of East Africa, but rather issues that matter East Africans.
Moses Havyarimana, Arusha, Tanzania.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Remember to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.